but sorry, six appointed by Republican presidents, but three appointed by Democratic presidents, kind of locking arms and deciding to ignore the Constitution, ignore the plain text of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which clearly states that insurrectionists cannot run for office. They decided to lock hands and ignore that because it would be too messy for the country to apply the law to Donald Trump. That's what happened yesterday and was very disappointing to listen to.
I mean, it's fascinating, Ellie, when you look at who Jason Murray is, right? The lawyer for Colorado that is trying to keep Trump from the ballot as an insurrectionist. He both clerked for Elena Kagan, a liberal justice, and for Neil Gorsuch, right? The justice from Colorado.
Mm-hmm. And both Gorsuch and Kagan lit him up. Yesterday, Kagan was extremely concerned. The first sound that you played wasn't Sotomayor, it was actually Kagan. And as you played, Kagan was extremely concerned with the ability of Colorado to kind of on its own exclude Trump from the ballot and the knock-on effect that would have in all the different states. The best way that I can explain the liberal position or why the liberals took the position that they did is that I would say Kagan, Jackson, Sotomayor to some extent, they were more concerned with a red state, a Republican legislature, a Republican governor kicking somebody like Joe Biden off the presidential ballot for bad faith reasons that they were willing to stop Colorado from kicking Trump off the ballot for good faith reasons. And while I get that calculus as a real politique method, it is a problem when your legal decisions, when your legal rulings are based on what you think the bad faith guys will do with it, right? Like, that's a problem if the law gets reduced to like, oh my God, what will Ron DeSantis do? Like, that's not a good way to run a country, but that is the way that we saw the liberals want to play it yesterday. And I think the other point, Amy, that's worth mentioning, you brought up who the lawyer for the Colorado side was. Let's not forget who the lawyer for the Trump side was, right? Let's not forget who Jonathan Mitchell is. He is the former Texas Solicitor General who is most famous for inventing Texas's SB 8, the bounty hunter law that allows people to pursue abortion providers in Texas that effectively overruled Roe v. Wade before the Supreme Court overruled Roe v. Wade. That's the guy the Trump campaign dragged out to make their argument that he should stay on the ballot. And that's the guy that apparently all nine justices found a way to agree with yesterday.
So I also wanted to ask you about the line of questioning of Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson and the whole issue of what it means to be an officer in the 14th Amendment. And also talk about the history of this case, why Colorado invoked it, going back to the Civil War, what it means for an insurrectionist to run for office.
Yeah, I mean, this is the double-edged sword of Justice Jackson, right? She is fantastic, amazingly smart, and she is a textualist, right? She is an originalist, a liberal version of those words, but she is the person who kind of goes toe-to-toe with Neil Gorsuch whenever they want to talk about the original public meaning of this or that, right? She's the one who goes right in to the, you know, Oxford English Dictionary to fight Gorsuch about the definition of what is, right? That's who she is. And that's great most of the time, right? But yesterday, that intellectual consistency led her to what I think is a quite tortured place, where she was parsing the word office versus offices, officer versus offices, to try to find some way to not include President Trump. And the problem with that is that it's ridiculous, right? It is just ridiculous as a matter of common sense to think that the people who said that you can't be a senator if you raised a rebellion against the government, and you can't be a congressperson if you raised a rebellion against the government, but president, yeah, sure, that's fine. We don't have a problem with, like, that's a ridiculous argument, but that's what she talked herself into. And again, I think she talked herself into that. I think the liberals generally talked themselves into that because they don't like the political reality of what the law says. They don't like the idea of kicking Trump off the ballot. They don't like what that means kind of as a precedential value around the country. And so they twisted themselves into a pretzel to pretend that the law says something that it doesn't.
Well, Ali, I want to ask you about the long-awaited ruling this week on Trump's claim to be immune from criminal prosecution, which you write about in your piece headlined, "The D.C. Circuit Just Shredded Trump's Immunity Claims." The court's decision should put to rest the question of whether a former president is immune to prosecution. The question is whether the Supreme Court will allow that, you wrote. So lay out how this three-judge panel unanimously rejected Trump's argument and what could happen next.
Yeah, speaking of stupid arguments, the argument that the president of the United States, once he is no longer clothed in power, is free to commit any crime he would like without fear of prosecution. The idea that if a president of the United States commits crimes while he is in office, he is somehow immune from ever being prosecuted for those crimes, even when he's out of office, that is ridiculous. Nobody reasonable believes that. And the D.C. Circuit panel, the three-judge panel, two judges appointed by Democrats, one by a Republican, unanimously ruled that Trump was wrong on every single level of his argument. It was a total, like what I called it, was a bench slap. They destroyed that argument. As well they should. It's a ridiculous argument. But does that end the issue? No. Because remember, folks, Trump is not trying to win with this ridiculous immunity argument. He is trying to delay with this ridiculous immunity argument. He was due to be put on trial by Judge Tanya Chutkan and Prosecutor Jack Smith on March 4th. Then he started making this immunity argument. Well, then Judge Chutkan ruled that that immunity argument was wrong because, again, it is obviously wrong. But now he got to appeal, right? So that appeal took a month, right? Took a month for the D.C. Circuit to write it. Chutkan has already moved back her March 4th trial day, right? So what happens next? Well, he's going to take the D.C. ruling and appeal it to the Supreme Court. Now, again, when he gets to the Supreme Court, if the Supreme Court takes it, he will lose again because his argument is ridiculous. And I think even after what I heard yesterday, I do not think there are five justices up there who will say that the president is immune from, that a former president is immune from prosecution. That's just not true, right? So I don't think they're going to do it. But the question is whether or not they grant the case at all and whether or not they allow him to continue to delay the start of his trial while he makes this ridiculous argument. The court doesn't have to take the case. And if the Supreme Court does want to take the case, it doesn't have to grant a stay. It doesn't have to stop Judge Tanya Chutkan from moving forward with her trial. But if there are four or five conservatives willing to allow Trump to delay, willing to allow him to essentially hack the legal process to try to keep himself out of jail long enough to run for president again, then Trump will potentially be able to delay his trial into the summer, through the conventions, maybe even past the next election, which is his whole game. Because the idea that he's actually going to win on this particular argument is never in the cards for him, and he knows it, and anybody rational knows it as well.
Well, this week, Donald Trump renewed his request for the judge in his Georgia election interference case to disqualify Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis and dismiss the indictment, saying her, quote, egregious misconduct demands it. Willis has acknowledged she had a romantic relationship with the prosecutor she hired on the case, Nathan Wade. You have a piece for The Nation headlined, "The Fannie Willis Scandal is Bad, but it doesn't change her case against Trump." Explain what you mean, Ellie.
Yeah, I don't think Fannie Willis should have done what she did, what she allegedly did, what she has admitted to, even in some ways. I don't think that's a good look. I don't think she should have done that. Right. I think that borders on unethical, but it has nothing to do with her ability to prosecute this case and the charges that she's brought against the 19 co-conspirators who tried to defraud the people of Georgia of their votes, right? It has nothing to, like, her personal, I think, foibles have nothing to do with the prosecution of that case, where, let us not forget, three people have already pleaded guilty to the charges that she brought. So we have to understand Fani Willis as a person who has professional responsibilities and a personal life. And her personal life, I think that was a mess. But her professional responsibilities are not in any way implicated by this particular scandal. There are different kinds of ethical, moral quandaries and scandals that potentially would implicate a prosecutor's ability to move forward with the case. This ain't one of them. This is just a bad look, right? So the idea that you can go from this personal issue and overplay it to the point where now you have to dismiss the whole case and she's racist and it's ridiculous. And I don't think a judge will go for it, but it's a bad look. I wish he hadn't done it.
And Elie Mystal, we haven't talked to you for a while since the E. Jean Carroll case, which really is significant. A jury voting more than $83 million for Trump defaming E. Jean Carroll after another civil trial found him guilty of sexually assaulting her. The judge saying in common parlance, it was rape. But when just before the jury found him liable for $83 million, Trump walked out of the closing arguments. Can you just summarize that case for us and where it's headed? Will he be paying this $83 million?
Yeah, Trump's a bit of a baby, and he threw a tantrum when he had to pay up the money for running his mouth. Like, let's not forget, there was an initial trial. He was found liable for defaming her. He was ordered to pay her $5 million, and then he kept defaming her. And then he kept running his mouth about her, right? And so that's why you had the second trial, and now it's an $83 million payment. And I'll tell you one thing, Amy, he's shut up about her now. He's made a lot of tweets, a lot of all caps, anger tweets. Haven't heard her name out of his mouth since the verdict, and that's the point. We perhaps finally found the price point that it takes to make Donald Trump shut up, and it's $83 million. I hope we all remember that figure. I hope other judges put $83 million fines on him to keep his mouth shut, because apparently that's what it takes. Will he have to pay it? You know, eventually. I'm not an economist. I don't understand the GDP of Trump org and how exactly that works. He has to post a bond. I don't know if he has the money. I don't know if he's going to fleece his, you know, MAGA supporters to send them their Social Security checks so he can pay off his legal fees. I don't know exactly how it's going to work, but I do know that the point was that he needed to shut up about her, and he has.
Finally, you know, we haven't talked to you since your debut on SNL, or was that Kenan Thompson? Let's take a look.
Hey, death threat for the nation. Do you think the media is overstating the negative sentiment of the election to get views and clicks?
Well, that's an interesting question.
Oh, is it? It's interesting. You find it interesting.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, well, I find you interesting, okay? You look like if Don King ate another Don King. I will unhinge my jaw and bite your head off like a goldfish cracker.
So you made it, Ellen. You made it. How are you feeling today?
I'm obviously a huge fan of Barry Gibb. I feel like he was done wrong by Jimmy Fallon. It was a nice moment for me, and what I've taken from that is that whatever the heck I'm doing, it seems to be working, so I should keep working and keep writing and keep trying to explain how our Justice Department and how our Supreme Court is deciding the rules that the rest of us have to live under.
So next time we're going to look at the Supreme Court, do we have to have Kenan Thompson on?
Oh, I hope so. I if one thing could happen, if I become in any small way a way for SNL to cover the Supreme Court a little bit more and to bring some knowledge to bear on its viewers that, you know, usually aren't listening to me about how the court actually operates and what it does in secret, then I will take every Don King joke they can throw at me if that's the upshot.
Elie Mystal, the nation's justice correspondent, thank you so much for joining us. We'll link to all your pieces. Elie Mystal is also the author of Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution. Coming up, we go to Pakistan for the latest in the country's national election. Stay with us.
ਜਾਣ ਦੀ ਪਸੂੜੀ ਨੂੰ ਜ਼ਹਿਰ ਬਣੇ ਹਾਂ ਤੇਰੀ ਜਾਵਾਂ ਮੈਂ ਪੂਰੀ ਨੂੰ ਆਉਣਾ ਸੀ ਉਹ ਨਹੀਂ ਆਇਆ ਦਿਲ ਬਾਗ ਬਾਗ ਮੇਰਾ ਟਕਰਾਇਆ ਕਾਗਾ ਬੋਲ ਕੇ ਦੱਸ ਜਾਵੇ ਪਾਵਾਂ ਕਿਉਂ ਦੀ ਚੂਰੀ ਨੂੰ ਰਾਵਾਂ ਚ ਬਾਵਾਂ ਚ ਉਹਨੂੰ ਲੁਕਾਵਾਂ ਕੋਈ ਮੈਨੂੰ ਨਾ ਰੋਕੇ ਮੇਰੇ ਡੋਲ ਜਗਾਈ
Pasuri by Ali Sethi and Shay Gill. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh, joined by Amy Goodman. In Pakistan, independent candidates affiliated with imprisoned former Prime Minister Imran Khan are leading the country's elections as official results continue to come in. The results so far have come as a surprise to many observers, given the extent of support to PTI loyalists. Khan supporters have accused Pakistan's military-backed interim government of trying to rig the election by shutting down cell phone and internet services just as voting began and by delaying election results. Khan was disqualified from running in Thursday's election because of criminal convictions he says were politically motivated. He was imprisoned in the run-up to the election. In a close second so far are candidates with the Pakistan Muslim League Party of three-time former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, who's backed by the military. Sharif returned to Pakistan in October after 4 years of self-imposed exile abroad to avoid serving prison sentences in corruption cases. Within weeks of his return, his convictions were overturned, leaving him free to seek a fourth term in office. And coming in third so far is the Pakistan People's Party, led by Bilawal Bhutto Zardari. For more, we're joined by Alia Amir Ali, Pakistani political activist and organizer. She's a member of the left wing of Awami Workers Party, normally based in Islamabad, but joins us today from London, where she's a graduate student at the London School of Economics. And in Karachi, we're joined by Munize Jahangir, journalist and host of a political talk show on Pakistan's leading news network, where she's been covering the elections. She's also editor-in-chief of the digital media platform VoicePK.net. She's co-chair of the Human Rights Commission of Pakistan. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Munize Jahangir, why don't we begin with you? Tell us what about the election results, what you see coming in, the latest news. I'm afraid we seem to have lost Munize. We'll try to get back to her. Alia Amir Ali, if you could comment on what you see coming out of Pakistan.
Yeah, I mean, I think, the fact that the results are continue to pour in so slowly and are so delayed is itself an indicator that whatever the results actually end up being, they're not particularly credible. And so I think that irrespective of the results, the political crisis that we're seeing in Pakistan is going to continue. And I think it's worth remembering that, you know, in Pakistan, this is not unusual. Like, elections have never been a straightforward affair where people just come out and make their will known. I mean, it's worth remembering that the first general elections in the country in 1970 were, in fact, not just dismissed by the military establishment, but, you know, ended up being the first time in history where a majority actually separated from a country. I'm referring to Bangladesh. And ever since then, I mean, elections in Pakistan have always been a more or less controlled affair. What I think is different, though, about these elections and what has been happening successively in Pakistan is an increasingly sort of this sort of military control over Pakistan's political affairs is becoming increasingly tense and untenable. We're seeing this time, you know, there's this very large, young and politicized electorate, and also an increasingly divided electorate. I mean, if we look at sort of, you know, just voting patterns and sort of how people are approaching and how meaningful elections are in the center versus Pakistan's peripheries, there's, you know, the gulf, the political gulf between center and periphery is increasing. And these elections are going to be, you know, are going to be a clear indicator of that. And I think finally, like, you know, quite irrespective of Imran Khan being the opposition, and I think, you know, at least the unofficial results that have been coming in over social media ever since yesterday do show that the PTI has gotten a lot of seats, and perhaps the official results will not reflect that as accurately as perhaps the actual sort of results have. But I think what it's worth remembering that the PTI is basically composed of electables who have belonged to different parties at different times, and, you know, who have sort of jumped ship, let's just say, from one party to the other in the past, who are basically local landlords, chieftains, businessmen, and have been part of the political establishment for a very, very long time. So I think in terms of what Pakistan is facing, you know, its economic crisis, its climate crisis, the ecological crisis, and then the political crisis in the peripheries, irrespective of who comes to power, neither the military leadership nor any of these political parties seem to have a solution to this.
Okay, we seem to have gotten Munize Jahangir back on the line. Munize, if you could respond to what's happening. You were following the election minute by minute for your own news program. What most struck you as results were coming in, and what do you see today? What are the results so far?
Well, one of the first things that is of immediate concern is that the results were supposed to be released this morning at 10 a.m. Now, several hours later, we still do not have the results of this, the complete results of this general election. And there is no clarity on who is going to be forming government in the center and who is going to be forming government in Punjab, simply because the symbol from the PTI, the Imran Khan-backed party, was taken away. And as a result, it threw up many independents. So right now in the league are PTI-backed independent candidates that are 52, and then following close is Nawaz Sharif-backed PMLN with 40 candidates. And then there's the Pakistan People's Party of the Bhuttos with 19 candidates. So it's up in the air exactly how many seats each party has got, and whether the PTI will be allowed to form a party and also, continue in the National Assembly in the form of a political party, which means that they will then get reserve seats, which will shore up their majority, and they will be in a clear position to then make government in the center. They are claiming that they can make government in the center and in the biggest province of Punjab, of Pakistan, which is Punjab. However, we have not seen the actual results. The problem in Pakistan has been that there was an election management system that was dependent on the internet. Now, internet signals went down, and earlier on, there were certain government ministers who kept on saying that there is a terror threat, and therefore we will be shutting down the internet. When there was an outcry over that decision, the government, the caretaker government, backtracked and announced that they will in fact not be blocking the internet. But lo and behold, when everybody woke up in the morning to go and vote, the internet across Pakistan and data services across Pakistan was being blocked. Even as we speak now, and it is the second day of the election, and it's 7 p.m. in Pakistan, we still do not have a proper signals across Pakistan. So as a result, people were not able to get to the polling stations the way they wanted. People, there was a fear factor that settled in. Having said that, we still saw a substantial turnout in this election. We still saw an eager voter wanting to go out and vote. We saw women come out in substantial numbers to come out and vote. And I think that was the biggest concern, that the people have spoken. They have voted against a party that was seen to be pro-establishment, and voted for a party that was seen to be against the establishment. But are the results going to be accepted? We are now getting information and reports from the ground that returning officers, which were appointed by the Election Commission to deliver the results, one of them in Lahore has been picked up. We do not know where he is. the candidate has cried foul and gone to the court. In other cases, we are seeing that the form that was supposed to be submitted, they are showing different numbers. The initial forms that were submitted to the Election Commission, which the media had got a hand of, which was called the Form 45, which the presiding officers were supposed to give the residing officers, they had a different outcome. And the one that the residing officers gave to the Election Commission has a different outcome. We are also receiving reports that the residing officers were confined to certain rooms by the military. And of course, these are reports that are unconfirmed, but certainly there is enough evidence to suggest that during the night there was significant manipulation of the results as they were coming out.
I want to go back to Alia Alomari, who is in London right now, but closely following the Pakistan elections. For a global audience, Alia, who are not closely following politics in Pakistan, if you can explain to us how the system is working right now. We saw the violence in the lead up to the election, candidates gunned down, the telecommunications going down. You had PTI barred, so Imran Khan's party, Imran Khan, who has been jailed for corruption, running as independents because the party is barred. Nawaz Sharif, who was imprisoned for a time, coming up second. Do you agree that all these independents that seem to be ahead now, they're saying the reason the results aren't in is because they're being tampered with, they're being finagled with? But for a global audience, to put this election in context and where the military stands, the Pakistani military stands in the middle of all of this, such a powerhouse in running Pakistan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. As I said earlier, I think it's important to remember the history of I prefer to use the term civilian rule rather than democracy, because it literally is just the battle for, elections to simply take place and their results to be accepted has been a constant struggle for Pakistan since its inception. We have to remember that the first general elections took place in 1970. The country was created in 1947. We've still spent more than half of our political history under direct military rule. And as I said earlier, where we began, the 1970 elections, the results were not accepted and we lost more than half of what was then, Pakistan as a result. And I think what has happened over time is that the military establishment has become more and more insecure, and that insecurity has meant greater attempts to manipulate and control not just the electoral process and its technicalities, but there's a whole sort of foreplay that happens beforehand about and alliances that are made. And in Pakistan, it's common knowledge for people to assume that governments are made. It's not that elections don't, like, that people's
votes
don't
matter. Alia, you have 10 seconds. 10 seconds.
Okay. So it's not that people's votes don't matter. It's just that, the military will certainly manipulate the results.
Alia Amir Ali, Pakistani political activist and organizer, thank you so much for joining us. Muniza Jahangir, journalist and host of a political talk show on Pakistan's leading news network. That does it for the show. I'm Nermeen Sheikh with Amy Goodman. A happy early birthday to Messiah Rhodes. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Woronoff, Charina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, and Tay Maria Estudio. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, this is Anuki, your Faculty of Environment representative, here to let you know what the SFSS is. The SFSS is a student union that is student-led, and it represents and advocates for the interests of the 26,000 undergraduate students at SFU. We are a non-for-profit support network and a voice at SFU, which provides services like the UPass and health and dental. We also provide support to make your student life better. You can reach the SFSS on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, or by emailing us. We look forward to hearing from you. Thank you.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia. We are diverse, independent, and yours.